Morning again, everyone. good to see you. We're at the beginning of the fourth book of the Torah, of the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, the five books, and it's Bamidbar, and it's always read the Shabbat before Shavuot, and Shavuot or Shavuos is coming up this coming Friday, so it's somehow got to figure out a reason why, right? That's always what we do, is we figure out this was not done coincidentally. Maybe it was. Was it? I don't think so. But I'm not going into a history lesson here, but just bear in mind, it took a very, very, very long time before the festival of Shavuot got associated with the giving of the Torah. It's not written anywhere in the five books. Okay, so this is something that is a product not only of rabbinic teaching. We get very little in the Mishnah, very little in the Gemara. It's much later on that we get this idea that on this the 50th day after the 7 weeks, Shavuot means weeks, right? There will be a festival honoring the giving of the Torah. Rather, in the Torah, it says that the 50th day will be a time of bringing first fruits, and it's called Yom HaBikurim, festival of the bringing of the fruits, which we'll read about in Parshat Bahar, a very beautiful ceremony where one recounts one's life and how one developed as a people and as an individual, and one being grateful for the fact that the earth can sustain us. So that's a much later idea, but now, of course, it's totally understood as what do we do in Shavuot? We celebrate the giving of the Torah. Remember, not the receiving necessarily. Okay, just bear that in mind for another time. The Torah is given. It's called, the rabbis call it Zman. Not the rabbis, later, Zman Matan Torateno. This is the time of the giving of our Torah. So I just want to just give you that historical overview, but I'm not really that interested, because one of the nice things about our tradition is that it really opens up the possibility of leaving the text behind to a certain degree, freeing ourselves from the actual literal meaning of things. That's really something that's very important, which a lot of people don't grasp about how we as Jews approach the Torah. We are not necessarily bound by the literal meaning of things, and that's why we have a tradition of interpretation. And the interpretation tradition you're all familiar with, but it's the possibility of basically taking things out of historical context, basically taking it out of historical context and going back to sort of, if you will, innate principles, if you will, about the world. So, for instance, the traditional ideas, of course, are that it's first of all, that it is given in the desert. Now, the word midbar itself is a complicated word. Does it mean desert? Does it mean wilderness? Is there a difference between the desert and the wilderness? Though those of you who have been to Sinai know that it's not a arid desert. It's not like the Gobi or the Sahara. It's a wilderness, and there is times of the year when flowers do emerge, plants do emerge. There are occasionally wadi floods that come and flood the land. So it's not a total, like, you know, they're climbing over like Lawrence of Arabia. That's not what it is. It's a wilderness. There's bushes and trees and there's all kinds of things. But the idea of the wilderness is that basically, why the wilderness? And the question, of course, has been answered in so many different ways. One of them is basically that the wilderness is free, meaning it costs nothing to enter it. And so the Torah is free. It's God's gift to us. Another spiritual reason you may have be aware of is the desert is a place, or the wilderness is a place of silence. There's usually nothing visual to distract you. There are no ambient noise to muffle sound. And to be sure, the Israelites received the Torah. There was was given the Torah. There was thunder, lightning, and all that. But basically, the idea is that the land of the wilderness, or the place of the wilderness, is a place that is it is a place that is hefker. That's a term that's used often. Hefker. Hefker means it belongs to no one, and because it belongs to no one, it basically is open to everyone. So this is a sort of a universal idea, that if the Torah had been given in any one specific place, a city or a town, it would not have this, if you will, range of influence and how to be accepted. And of course, our mystical tradition does a lot with this, and as I say, it removes it. So basically, they play with the word b-b-midbar, if you know the word is mem dalet bet resh, and they play with it, and we get that the wilderness midaber, that the wilderness speaks, or the wilderness speaks to us, right? It's a nice wordplay, and of course, people play on the fact that what they're saying is there is a sound of silence. You may have heard there was a very popular song by that name. So in a way, we are the people of the voice and not the people of the book. A book. So here are some basic themes, and we'll get a chance to discuss them. As I said, the desert is an empty place. The wilderness is barren and ownerless, symbolizing the humility required to receive divine wisdom. To connect with the infinite Torah, one must transcend the personal limitations and the barren, barren ego. Okay, so that's one possibility of seeing this. Vastness, and in the vastness, you basically see your own smallness, which is by observing it. There's also the what happens in the how the why it's called the Book of Numbers in English, in Latin, or Greek, is because it has in it the census, accounting, and it goes into very big detail about the names of the heads of the tribes. And it goes on to talk about a rearranging of the marching order of the people as they will continue through the midbar. And counting is seen by our tradition, by the mystical tradition, is not for military logistics alone, which is what would normally is being talked about. You count as many men who are 20 and over, in a sense, by finding out what kind of resources you have militarily. But they say that counting is seen as divine love. The census in this parsha is not for military, as I said, but represents a spiritual accounting. God counts the souls, treating each as a unique, beautiful, beloved entity, and highlighting the importance of the each individual within the community. There's also some language in this counting which says, Se'u, Rosh, lift up the names, lift up the people. So it's not just saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's basically how do you, according to the mystical tradition, how do you basically evince from everyone individually their if you will, individual sense of connection and love. Then it goes on, it talks about the Levites. The Levites are there to disassemble, carry, reassemble, if you will, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and it gives a particular role to one family of the three Levite clans. And it basically gives them this idea of their of the reason that they're not getting a share in the land is because they have this divine service. And of course, this is sort of a retrojection from the future into the past, because et cetera, we didn't know about them not getting any kind of portion in the land. And then there's also the idea as I said, repositioning the various tribes around the Mishkan, and the Levites are around the Mishkan, and that there is now a centrality. It's a different shape. No longer are they walking in a straight line, because if you remember when we talk about Amalek, Amalek had many things wrong with it, but one thing it is that they attacked the stragglers at the end, the weak, who couldn't keep up. So in order to prevent that, at least my understanding is, in order to prevent that, you create a new kind of structure where the vulnerable are now within protection of the camp. No one is left to be straggling below. And you get this idea of three tribes on each corner of this sort of square, and reminiscent of what we call later on the Roman square, when they used to engage in battles. Also, the tribes basically also represent how the Shekhinah, which of course is talked about, the divine presence in the Mishkan, is going to be the faux focus now. It's something that is, as we talked many times about the fact, the importance of things that are tangible, people wanting some tangible representation of their commitments. And then also the idea that the Levites who are transporting the Mishkan is basically like the soul inhabiting a physical body. And it represents a descent, Yirida, it's called in Kabbalistic language, Yirida, Litzorach Aliyah, descent for the sake of ascent. So the soul, like the ark, is covered by materialistic garments, quote unquote, to define divine sparks within the mundane world. So that's another understanding of what the ark represents. It represents the soul. And like us, we are covered with physicality, with physical, if you will, the body. I like, there's a very nice a Hasidic interpretation which emphasizes that the wilderness is not just a place, but it's a state of mind. And when a person feels spiritually arid or empty, that is a time when there is the deepest connection to God is formed, as it forces a total dependence on the divine. You no longer have the structures that you would have in the city, etc. And that's what it basically is. So the Midbar is ownerless. And one has to make oneself ownerless. What does that mean? It means that one must basically, the individual to receive the Torah, right? We have, remember, it's given, but it, to receive it, the Torah, the person must make him or herself hefker, very important word, ownerless. So the individual who is full of himself or herself will have difficulty accepting and following God's directives. A truly spiritual individual must have a degree of humility, anava, and being in the wilderness heightens that individual's awareness of the reality that their existence is insignificant when compared to the magnificent scale of creation. When explaining how one can come to love and fear God, Rambam Maimonides draws upon this idea through natural settings, not only. And this, of course, you'll hear from a lot of people. I'm very spiritual, and I find my spirituality in nature. And that's quite in line with this teaching. The way to love and fear God is when a person reflects on his actions and her great and wondrous creations, and they see within this wisdom that it's beyond comprehension. You get to the place where it's behind comprehension. It says you become befuddled, right? Another good word I think I want to like use is you become overwhelmed. It's not a cognitive, if you will, intellectual thing. You become filled with love and praise and exaltation and this great passion, if you will, to know the greatness of Hashem. And when one thinks further about these things, Rambam says he trembles, he stumbles backwards, is terrified. Remember the connection between the words, it's awesome and it's awful, you know, and the person realizes that he or she is a tiny, lowly, insignificant creature standing with an inferior intellect before the perfect intellect, as Rambam Maimonides would call God. Being an Aristotelian, he took the terminology of that, of the intellect. So by experiencing the wilderness, a person can be filled with both an overwhelming love for Hashem, God, and a recognition of their own limited and finite capabilities in contrast to God's infinite intellect and wisdom-filled creations. There's a lot more to say. I just don't want to get too into the weeds, even though there are a lot of weeds in the Midbar, I understand. But I'd like to also just say that one of the things that I found fascinating in doing a lot of work on this week was how basically the idea is that the Torah should not be associated with any one place. That's what it's all about. Because according to some thinking, if the Torah had been given in a city or a particular country, it would immediately be rejected by people who are not part of that country or that part of the world. So it was not necessary to remove the children of Israel from a specific place into a no man's land, if you want to call it, a place with emptiness. And when we abandon our ego, that's what I think a lot of this is basically driving at, and we achieve what is called anava, humility, one can become a receptive vessel of the Torah, which I really like that. In a sense. And this goes on to the whole idea of when was the Torah accepted, and it goes on with a very interesting midrash, and the Torah was accepted, believe it or not, at Purim, because of a phrase in chapter 9 of the Megillah, which says after they received epistle from Mordechai and Esther, the people accepted it fully. Ki muvi ki blu. And that word accepted is seen as perhaps it was only then that the Torah really was received. Why? Because of another midrash, which you're all familiar with, about the fact that according to some, the mountain, when it says that the people stood tachat hahar, around, we translate as around Mount Sinai, but they take it literally that the people were tachat under Mount Sinai. What does that mean? That the mountain was lifted above them, and they were said, if you accept the Torah, great, if not, I will drop this on you, and this will be your final resting place. And of course, putting discretion before valor, people say, okay, I accept it, but it was an acceptance, if you will, that was a result of coercion. And one is not able to enter into a contract or a covenant in full faith if there's a sense of coercion. So this is why they say they needed, it was only at Purim, when there was no coercion to accept this, that they accepted. So this idea of the midbar being a dangerous place as well, a place where you really deal with life and death on a regular basis. It's different perhaps in a city. Leads us to understand that this parsha, even though it's a narrative and it's a census and it's counting, and I won't go into the whole issue of whether the counting is accurate or not, but it comes out with a really remarkably large number of people, 20 and over, about 600,000, meaning if you took it and you extrapolated from it, you would have a crowd of 2 million people walking through the midbar. And of course, that's kind of hard to understand, but I won't leave that for Torah study tomorrow morning. So let's just summarize by saying, where is that emptiness in us? Where is it that we find that possibility? And of course, it's in silence. In silence, we let things emerge. And I think it happens to all of us as we sit together. I know when you sit together, all of a sudden things come up. The practice, however, is let that go, because guess what? Something else will come up. There's a voice that emerges out of silence, and that voice is within us as well. And it's based upon a sense of being counted on as an individual, the importance of individuals being counted. We say, you know, I can count on you, and you can count on us. And the souls are being counted, if you will. And each one is treated as unique. And it highlights the importance of each individual within the community. And then later, of course, protecting the Mishkan, protecting the inner self. We do it by creating a new kind of faux focus around our lives. That's how we protect our inner spirits. And then finally, the fact that we have to sometimes get down into the physical, like the Levim who transport the tabernacle. They're not transporting, it's set up. It doesn't have any function when it's put together, when it's not put together. So they basically enter into the physicality of setting up this ark, setting up this Mishkan, so the Mishkan can fulfill all the important communal and spiritual needs for the people. So too do we enter into the physicality of our lives with the realization that most of what is around us are really garments. They're not the true self. And if you want to find the divine sparks within the mundane world, you have to, if you will, go through the materialism to something much more deep. And it's not a, it's a strange concept in Eastern traditions as well, that the physicality is only a garment that could be taken off when one doesn't necessarily gets, I mean, you don't want to get stuck in the mundane. And mundane is very important, but you don't want to get stuck there. You want to have the capacity of experiencing the extraordinary in the mundane. That's really the hard part, right? How do you see all those things that pass by us, all the things that we enter into, all the relationships, all of the everyday commitments? How do we see that basically giving us an opportunity to experience the extraordinary within the ordinary? So, Bamidbar, and where are we? Where are we today? I often feel like I'm in the wilderness a lot, and it's a journey. It's a journey. It's a journey from, at least according to the Torah, it's a journey from from slavery, however you want to understand that. That can be understood in so many ways. From slavery to a new intimacy, if you will, a new intimacy with God, because that's how I often see what happened at Sinai, and I don't want to go into a whole lecture about that, but I see what happened at Sinai was an intimate encounter with the extraordinary. That's what I would see. It's an intimate encounter with the extraordinary. Some people would say call that God, whatever, but it's the extraordinary coming down and becoming something within our reach. So the Torah says that God descends on the mountain. Why would that be important, right? It doesn't have to, but because there's an opportunity by the descent, if you will, of God into, for me to rise up and to meet it in a sense, in an intimate sense, that it's no longer just, if you will, an accident, but there's a certain intentionality. And of course, that's why much later on, a lot of the mystics will talk about the event at Sinai as a marriage. And the Ten Commandments become the ketubah, if you will. And we basically agree to enter into this relationship out of love and out of abandoning our ego needs, which one has to do in any relationship, particularly in the marriage relationship. And that's very hard to do. And that's why it's a struggle. And this struggle of maintaining intimacy, removal of our own ego needs, and all that is a challenge. And it's a challenge that I think many would love to take on. Others will demur from it as well and say, no, not for me. I don't need the challenge. Let God be there. Let me be here. And there's no need for that kind of intimate encounter. But I believe that one of the things that makes our tradition so vital is that it does ask of us, if you will, to enter into a relationship. And relationships are hard. We continue to do that. And every year when we talk about this connection of Bamidbar and the giving of the Torah, we begin to realize that Shavuot can be understood as more than just 7 weeks, but the Shavuot can be seen as a time of you bringing, if you will, the best of yourself to the relationship that we have. And that's, as I say, it's not always easy to do. So I've talked too much, and I'd like to open it up a little bit. So there was a lot to cover, I know. So.